Good evening. This is Module 18, Talk 2, Buddha Nature, How the Sun Sees the Clouds. And the reading is in the Heart Attack Sutra, basically pages 57 to 66, although we're going to be going back before that for various things here. So the overview, how the sun sees the clouds. Metaphorically speaking, we've been told many, many times that the reason why we do not see the sun is because of the clouds, which metaphorically are representing our own confusion. We've been told that many times and getting kind of tired of it maybe. So today we are going to turn this metaphor upside down. We're going to ask, how does the sun see the clouds? The sun in this case represents the Buddha or any other realized teacher. And we are going to ask, what does that realized teacher see, looking at the world, rather than what do we see, where we appear to be sentient beings who are covered with some form of cloud of confusion, ranging on many levels. But we don't need to go into that. We're going to get to the sun. So very briefly to review, one of the major topics last week was the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma. So we have the Hinayana, which is the first wheel, which is about suffering. It's about the Four Noble Truths. And if we really wanted to get technical, it would be about everything in the Abhidharma, that is, everything that has lists, not just skandhas, not just nidanas, ayatanas, dhatus, realms, things, samskaras, all those lists, because we see them refuted here. So in order to refute them, they must have been in the Hinayana. And they're all about how one can learn to avoid suffering on a personal level. And the second turning of the wheel is the Mahayana level of compassion and emptiness. And Carl Brunholtl says this is the level on which the Heart Sutra takes place. In this level, it's all about emptiness, but emptiness is never talked about. Instead, what's talked about is how to work towards seeing emptiness. So it's about wisdom. And wisdom is not the same as emptiness. Emptiness cannot be talked about, but wisdom, one has something to say. It's intended to move us towards the experience of emptiness. And the third turning of the wheel is Mahayana also. And the topic is Buddha nature, which is what we actually are going to need today. So I can't quite agree with Carl that the Heart Sutra is only about the second turning. We need the third turning if we're going to talk about Buddha nature and the how the Buddha sees the world. And we will also get to what's called the ultimate meaning, which is how we start to see more and more how the layers of meaning that we think we have actually can be transcended, and we get to deeper and deeper levels. So, an easy question: are the three turnings the same as the three yanas?
No.
Okay, what is it? Yes?
Well, it's the third yana is Vajrayana, right?
And yeah.
This is different. But we thought some of us thought last week. That would be simpler. One less thing to memorize.
Okay. So the third yana is Vajrayana, which is not something we explicitly teach here. We only do it implicitly. So, did anyone pick up on the flaming sword of Prajna?
What do you think?
Oh.
Picked up on that a long time ago.
Oh, right. Let's hear it, babe.
So the flaming sword of Prajna cuts both ways. It cuts into our belief of a solid objective reality, as well as the subjective observer.
Okay.
And the one who wants to take credit for being on the Bodhisattva path.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. Yes. What was that last one?
And the one who wants to take credit for being on the Bodhisattva path.
So
it's kind of identifying. It's not just the subjective me. It's also the me that's pretty proud of the fact that I'm on this path to give myself up. So I thought that was the funniest.
So,
I love that one.
Oops. So what's the flaming part of it? I understand
that's
the
interesting
sides.
Questions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I understand the double edge, but I understand
it's flaming, right.
Brilliance.
It's just so smart.
Brilliant.
And sharp, and it's very powerful.
But what about the flame?
What about the flame?
What's the flame? What happens when
something's
burns?
Burning.
And
oh,
then...
Yeah.
What happens, like, if you burn a log? What's
smoke.
And what's left?
Ashes.
So it consumes. Empties.
Right.
But, yeah, so it's a concept?
It certainly consumes all possible conceptual thinking, yes. Now, I tried to get a good image of it, and that proved to be very difficult.
It's on the back here.
And especially copyright images. So this is not very good, but at one point, very briefly, Carl Brunholzl does describe Prajna Paramita as a lady, and so there actually is an image for her. Here, the sword is like so. Can you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's held up. Usually at something like a 45-degree angle, straight up over the head. And it is two-edged, as you pointed out, and the flames are... Those flames are hot. And they're red. They aren't quite the red of the American flag. No Oriental culture really likes that red. It's a slightly more orangey red.
It's from cochineal.
What?
It's from cochineal, which is bugs. It's how they make the dye.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And that will make...
That color.
That will make that red?
From the bugs.
Okay, that's interesting.
It's all around the world. All natural dyes. Mm-hmm.
No, it's okay.
That's interesting.
Fine.
Yeah, interesting, yeah.
And what is... That's in her right hand. And what is she holding in her left hand? It seems to be, yeah, it's resting on a lotus, but what is it?
Yeah.
Is it a book?
It's a book, yes. Mm-hmm. Which represents the Dharma in all sorts of ways, whether it's physical Dharma or virtual Dharma, whatever. It is Dharma. And she is depicted as having a yellow color, and her two lower arms are in a meditation posture, I believe. However, we don't have a good image for her, and this is sort of a not terribly satisfactory substitute.
Why are there always, why not always, why are there often four arms?
Why does she have four arms?
But there are other ones that have four arms. There are other...
There are deities that have two arms, four arms, six arms.
Okay.
And sometimes Avalokiteshvara.
So 100.
Yeah.
100
arms.
1,000.
In some images of Avalokiteshvara, he saw sentient beings and he felt such compassion that his head split and he actually manifested 1,000 arms.
Or eyes. What about the eyes? Didn't have a lot of eyes.
Same thing.
Same thing?
Yeah, right.
Oh, the eye, the hands. They had
eyes
in his
eyes.
Hands.
Yeah.
1,000 arms. Mm-hmm. So he could see the suffering of sentient beings.
Mm-hmm.
This one's got pretty amazing ears, too.
Yeah.
They're like Buddha ears. Yeah. They're all the adornments which deities tend to have. Earrings, crowns of various sorts. Don't look too hard, you'll see it's wrong. So there's a lot of discussion on the flaming sword of Prajna. There's it's all over the place. I don't know if you want to pick out any particular things, but I see references, for instance, on the...
Does the flame also denote the way it doesn't just cut through the illusion, also illuminates it?
Ah, yes.
Mm. So the flame kind of illuminates it, because it shows you the illusion as well.
Yeah. It's luminosity, too.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yes, which is a third turning aspect of it, right?
Yeah.
Because it's... That would be Buddha nature.
Mm.
Okay. So that seems like we've kind of hit a bit on the third question, but we can talk about the sword, or we can talk about what is Buddha nature. And you can pick up what needs to be picked up. There are some interesting discussions of... Page 13, for instance, when we are far away at sea from any land and we let a land-dwelling bird fly from our ship, the bird does not get very far. Eventually, it will always come back to the ship because it's the only place for it to land. In the same way, our thoughts and emotions always try to go somewhere or fly into the sky of exciting things, which is they're trying to get away from our mind. But is it possible? But they cannot go anywhere outside of our mind, and eventually they will always settle back into the very mind in which they arose. Therefore, we do not have to nail down our thoughts. It is okay if they move. Even if they move far away, we do not have to worry about them, run after them, send out a search party. I thought that was a good image.
I remember Pema Chodron saying that she'd always say that the mind was like telling a dog to stay, stay. And then she said, but then a student actually said something she thought was even better, which was, it's more like, come on back, come on back, stay.
But you don't need to tell it that. That's sort of, at one level, maybe one does need to do that. And then later on, as one deepens... that can be dropped.
Mm-hmm.
And then the dropping of that can be dropped and so on. Actually, different understandings of the turnings of the wheel are given on page 22, where it says, just as a grammarian initially teaches the alphabet, how does the Buddha teach the Dharma? Just as those to be guided can absorb it, to some he teaches a dharma of how to avoid evil. to some how to accomplish merit, to some try to understand what duality is, that is, a dualistic discussion of mind and how to quiet mind, or tries to teach duality, or what is profound and frightening to the fearful, and to some the means for enlightenment, that is emptiness with a heart of compassion.
Would you repeat that?
Do you have it?
It's 22.
It's 22.
Yeah.
It's a whole bunch of different levels of understanding there.
Okay. Just as a grammarian initially teaches the alphabet, the Buddha teaches the Dharma just as those to be guided can absorb it. To some, he teaches the Dharma in order to turn them away from evil. To some, so that they accomplish merit. To some, what is based on duality. To some, what is based on non-duality. To some, what is profound and frightening to the fearful. And to some, the means for enlightenment. That is emptiness for the heart of compassion.
So the sutta is about emptiness with the heart of compassion. That's said right pretty early. And it happens to be, according to Carl, the only Prajnaparamita Sutra in which Avalokiteshvara, who is the very bodhisattva of compassion, is the invited guest, which is a clue that the heart of this is about compassion. And furthermore, he points out on page 23 near the top that one doesn't teach how to perfect emptiness. That's not possible. Emptiness is already perfect. One cannot teach such a thing. One can teach how to perfect wisdom, which is the work we do to accomplish compassion. This insight is called prajna, means to see how things actually are through finely and thoroughly discriminating them. When that insight has reached its highest point, it is called prajnaparamita, the perfection of prajna.
The perfection of what? Prajna.
The perfection of prajna. In other words, we keep... did you want to say something?
Yeah, it's sort of interesting to me, the perfection of prajna, because prajna is a process.
Yes.
And that when you start out, you're not just suddenly wise or have wisdom, but it's prajna is part of that.
Yeah, prajna is wisdom, yes.
But it's not...
fixed.
It's right.
None of those perfections are fixed.
It's not a...
static. They're all dynamic. They're all engaged, how we engage ourselves.
But in the Paramita, it says prajna being the... highest?
Highest. Mm-hmm. Of the six, yeah.
You can say that.
It's still not... I don't know, how do you know when you have prajna? It's, in other words, it's not a perfect state. Prajna itself is not a perfect state.
No, you said it, it's a process. Yeah.
The perfection, though, is... when they say it's a perfection, it's one of the excellent practices of the bodhisattva path.
Right.
So we enter wherever we can, you know.
Right.
But at the same time, they are excellences or perfections in themselves as ways to develop and ways to pursue our experience. So it's all intrinsically perfect in itself.
But the word wisdom carries so much odd weight with it that you almost think that, oh, I have wisdom. As if that's always, when you have it, it's always there. But just like generosity, you're not always generous, and you're not always patient, and you're not always meditating. You don't always have discipline. Same thing with wisdom.
But you have it.
For sure.
You have it, right? You just don't access
it. But it is possible to touch it.
Yes, it is, right.
It's available.
It's available. Yeah, it's available.
Yeah. Always. It's right. Part of
it. It's just really kind of cool.
I have a question, though. So the prajna, it's always available. Is a piece of it clearing away other stuff so you see it? Mm-hmm. So that you actually access it instead of using your confused thoughts to say, I know what the best thing is because I'm so smart and I'm so clever.
You access
and that's
more.
When you don't get the prajna because you're so it's all about me and it's not about wisdom. Yeah. But is that...
But prajna is also what clears things away. That's
so
the tool.
You see through your thoughts.
It's kind of like a self-perpetuating energy that once you... It seems to me once you start having an awareness of your own mind, you start waking. The prajna process sort of perpetuates itself. It uncovers itself almost, if that makes sense.
In other words, we'll visit it again and again, deeper each time if we're working on it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was the integration of all the other paramedias.
Well, in some sense, yes. In some sense, look beyond that, both. Yeah. There's something about this issue of effort on page 53, which I like. He starts about saying how koans in the Zen tradition are not really presented to make us understand how things are. They're just methods for letting go of something we thought is right or wrong, good or bad, something we think or know. Given that approach, from a more pessimistic point of view, we could say that the Buddha's path is simply one of one disappointment after the other. The only good thing is that enlightenment is the last one.
Final disappointment.
Final disappointment.
Is that what it says? The final disappointment.
I'm reading.
It's just reading.
I'm reading towards the bottom of page 50.
Yeah, I got your book.
Yeah.
So it says the final disappointment.
But it goes on.
Okay.
On a more positive note, we could say that if we go through the intricacies of training the mind in not clinging, it is like training to be a top-notch ballet dancer. When we see those people, their movements seem so light, full of grace, and completely without effort. So here this issue of effort is coming up. Completely without effort. But actually, the training is very hard, and they have to pay attention to every minute detail every day over and over again. The effortlessness and the lack of rigidity or holding on to anything comes only through intense training. And then he brings that back to the mind. Likewise, when we train our mind, non-grasping simply does not happen out of the blue. For most people, some training is necessary in order to get beyond any need for training.
Huh. Well, and then there's the conundrum that the concept, I mean, it's about letting go of concepts, but then the idea of letting go of concepts is a concept.
Right.
Sure.
So we keep cycling.
Really,
I can conceptualize anything.
Yeah.
Well, did anybody listen to the tape, the Chikanda Rinpoche's talk,
the Heart Sutra?
The Heart Sutra
on
talk.
Class two. Seth heard it.
Yeah,
wasn't that fabulous?
please listen to it.
Yeah, it's really
because
incredible.
She really cuts right through this conceptual, our attachment to having the answer and getting the and holding on to the. So we know what the hell we're talking about.
Yeah, let's grab it.
You know, we own our own wisdom and we own our own intelligence. And I've got she's like the sword of prajna.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, is she
all
like,
the time.
She's just.
So she says we don't own that.
We don't own it.
Yes, you're right.
What was that?
Well, you are so smart.
She says what?
She says we don't own it.
We don't own it.
So please listen to that. I think it would be very helpful to
it's
this.
It's a great
end.
Talk for the.
We don't own it. Furthermore, there's no one to own it.
No, of course, first of all, there's what it.
What's
it? There's no it.
It and no us.
No owner.
Yeah, so more and
no
more
object.
Is taken away.
Which is very, because we're working really hard, so why are we working so hard?
Right?
Why, yeah. If there's nothing, well, that's where it's taking
yeah,
a detour.
That's going to take up the whole.
Oh, yeah, okay, sorry.
Everything.
That's right?
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Michael, I just wondered if we could just, I could interject one other thing.
Yeah.
That when Harold Robert said that he thought that wisdom was the kind of culmination of kind of getting, if I understood you correctly,
integration
of all those other paramitas, and then you get that wisdom thing. And I just wanted to say, to call it, not to make a big deal out of that right now, but no. I mean, it isn't sort of like you're going to accomplish generosity, and then you're going to accomplish, well, which one should, let's try patience. And I'm really going to accomplish
that. I want to be a third degree. Black belt in
paramita. In the paramita practice. So that concept. You
that's
just
why
sort
we send you to Conroe Imagery.
Yep. I can't wait.
Oh, boy.
May. I meet her in May.
Oh,
that's,
May.
That's wonderful.
Oh. Okay. Going to London.
Oh, geez. You don't do anything little.
Like your friend sent me so.
Okay, that's good.
Does anyone want to say anything? We're going to return to this later, but does anyone want to say anything? What is Buddha nature?
Yeah.
Well, then we'll get back to it.
Later. Come on, John.
Slow it down, John. Come on.
John's
thinking
about it.
Oh, no.
Yeah, he's got something.
Well, I don't know if I do. It's one of those things like I have some notions about it. I'm not sure I know how to articulate it. I think the way, and I have done the reading, the way I think I understand this is that, well, really simply, we're already Buddha, right? And we're, enlightenment is our natural state, and the wisdom we're talking about is seeing the confusion, the way we misunderstand our experience, sort of peeling away.
Okay, I'm not sure quite what you intended as the last, very last part of it.
Right, the peeling away.
So if, I guess the way I think of this is that if we're already there, right, if enlightenment is in some way naturally present with us, then the path is one of increasingly seeing reality as it is, and that's wisdom. That's how I understand it.
Okay. So, what we're going to have to do in the last section, which I think hopefully is the meat of the course, is how does the Buddha see the world, rather than how do we see it? And that would be Buddha nature. Whatever that is.
Yeah.
Now, very quickly, do we need to talk about vulture flock or vulture peak? I think you already did that a couple
well,
of times.
Well, last fall.
Emily has been there.
Yes, you were there.
Yeah. I have some stones.
The great gathering of the Sangha.
The great gathering.
Not that many people.
Oh, I don't know. There were like 30 of us in our group. Nobody else was up there, but there was... There are a lot of steps, but it's not that high.
No.
It's quite a view, though, because it's a plain, you know, so anything above the plain, you can see a long way. So.
It's anyway. Not a mountain range, yeah. It's
no,
a little
it's not,
hill.
It's a hill.
Not very high, you can walk up it.
Yeah.
Okay, anyway, what is an arhat? What is a bodhisattva? Oh, well, we have three main actors. Very briefly, for the three of them, what does each do in the sutra? You've heard it enough times. The Buddha, Avalokiteshvara, and Shariputra. What does each one do?
The Buddha's in meditation.
Yep. Until the very end.
Yeah. 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 And he says, you're all great.
Good job. Way to go.
And Avalokiteshvara, what happened with him?
He did the teaching.
Yeah, but before he did the teaching, he saw.
He saw the five skandhas.
Yeah. The Buddha, the radiation of the Buddha inspired him, and all of a sudden he understood. He saw the five skandhas and everything else involved.
So was he in samadhi also?
He was practicing the samadhi.
Yeah.
It doesn't say that.
It doesn't say it. But
they're all sitting around meditating, right?
Well, the... It says through the inspiration of the Buddha, Avalokiteshvara saw the five skandhas to be empty of nature. So he had a tremendous realization where the Buddha was radiating.
Is that enlightenment? Is that his enlightenment?
Well,
not necessarily.
Not perhaps.
We're not talking about enlightenment. We're talking about prajna.
Okay.
That's what we're talking about.
So maybe not, keep it simple. Not quite there. But
enlightenment kind of answered is kind of like final at some level when you bring that up. But this is actual process of what happened.
But pretty advanced compared to
it's
us.
It's a high moment of prajna.
Oh yeah.
You could say, I mean, this could be taking place in one person, Buddha, right. Your own Buddha nature flashes this dimension of luminosity or illumination, and at that point the prajna kicks in.
Well, Buddha nature is a prajna. It's egolessness. That seems to me a prerequisite of Buddha nature. Is the egolessness.
But we were talking about how Buddha nature is kind of like the sun.
Yeah.
Which is looking at the, right. Sees the clouds, yes. Rather than us seeing the clouds.
Yes.
If the Buddha sees the clouds, then the clouds, from that perspective, is very different.
That's what we're going to get to later. Yeah. So for the moment, yeah.
What you just said is that you don't get to Buddha nature.
That's no.
So, right? You understood.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's what you meant to say.
No, you don't get to Buddha nature. And it's just that.
It's already self-existing.
It's that. Right. But it's devoid of ego.
See it. Right, but I heard by what you said that it was sort of an achievement of Buddha nature.
No, okay. No.
Okay, I don't think so.
Buffy had something here.
But I was saying you get to see it, though. I mean, you achieve... Yeah.
Okay, we're going to.
It's an interesting question.
We're going to have to move on because we should get to the third section.
But just
because we need to get there.
Okay. Prajna is actually the perception process to see the five skandhas to be empty of nature. That's where it is. Okay. And then you realize what you're looking at is how the makeup of the ego is from the five skandhas from a confused point of view. But from an illuminated point of view, they come totally empty in themselves.
Okay, so we have the Buddha, we have Avalokiteshvara, who attained a very high realization. But he didn't. What had to happen before he could give a discourse?
He had to be asked.
He had to be asked. So that was the role of Shariputra, right? So Shariputra was an arhat, and we can assume that he was a high achiever as an arhat, that is, he had understood personal liberation for the self quite well, and yet he had the courage to go beyond that and question. And that's what we want to...
So what is an arhat again?
Someone who has achieved a realization of how to liberate oneself personally from suffering, okay? Whereas a bodhisattva has a totally different outlook, which is not self-liberation, but liberation of all sentient beings.
So is arhat only in the Hinayana?
Yes.
And
arhat is a...
And the bodhisattva
has accomplished
the
Hinayana. Yeah.
Got it.
And a bodhisattva is certainly a Mahayana person who has come, at the very least, started the work of how to benefit all sentient beings without regard to oneself.
So you leave behind the question of self-liberation as being a goal. It doesn't mean it doesn't mean that people who are in the Mahayana don't work on themselves and actually deal with Hinayana issues, but that's not the main thrust. You realize the main thrust is benefiting and helping all beings attain liberation. Yeah. So that's where the emphasis goes.
Okay, so all of this is encompassed now within a brief few pages called the title, surprisingly.
You get the grand prize if you can pronounce this word.
I'll give it a shot.
Bhada Vida Prajna Paramita Shru. That's this
part. Start again.
Bhagavati Prajna Paramita
Prajna Paramita Ridaya.
Sanskrit didn't basically, if you read Sanskrit, there's no break between words. It's just one long sentence. On the other hand, if you break this up, you know, Bhagavati Prajna Paramita Hridaya Sutra. And the Hridaya means heart. Bhagavati is basically glorious, or the Bhagavat is the person illuminated. And then the Prajna Paramita, you know. So it's just a combination of several words that are run together.
Okay, so we have two translations of this here. The one we've been using is the Sutra of the Heart of Transcendent Knowledge. And Carl Brunholzl gives the Sutra of the Heart of the Glorious Lady Prajna Paramita. So she's a lady, and we've gone over a little bit of iconography, but we don't have time to do much more with that.
I'm sorry, Michael, what is Bhagavati? Mm-hmm.
That's the blessed female. It's the feminine for blessed one. Bhagavat is the Buddha, or as a blessed one, illuminated one, male. Bhagavati is feminine.
Does that have anything to do with how feminine is wisdom?
Yes.
Exactly. Yes, that's the question we now have to get to. Okay.
Right.
So, why is Prajna Paramita depicted as feminine? Why is she the mother of all the Buddhas?
But everybody was once her mother.
Well, but it's not talking about ordinary mothers.
Right.
Well, now you're talking about, that's called sentient beings.
Yeah. Right. She is wisdom out of which all the Buddhas are born.
Right.
Buddhas are born out of the wisdom of Prajna Paramita in a profound sense, not a physical sense of human birth. So I think you've...
I have a question, but it's kind of on a tangent, so I'll wait.
Well, but you're about to ask a second question, I think. If the sun symbolizes wisdom and is feminine, what does the moon symbolize? That's not discussed here. Does anyone want to make a guess?
The thing you're pointing at.
What? What do you think of the moon would be then, as a symbol?
Emptiness?
No, she is emptiness, okay? Prajna Paramita. The moon is seen as masculine, and it's
watching
skillful means. Okay.
So we briefly introduced the notion of what we call skillful upaya.
Yeah.
Prajna is feminine, upaya is masculine. So they work together.
I have a question later about the bardo.
Bardo, wait a minute. No, this is not bardo.
No, we're not talking about bardo.
So the moon symbolizes skillful means, right?
What?
The moon symbolizes skillful means.
Means skillful means. In other words, the sun is primordial emptiness, which gives birth to the Buddhas, seen as feminine. Wisdom is ultimately seen as feminine. It doesn't mean
female,
a female or male person, nor does the other one. Skillful means is the moon and is seen as the masculine aspect of putting it into action.
Okay, Eric.
Well, it's interesting because the sense of female, we can get really hung up on that, on female versus male. And the thing is that, in the sense the mother is being referred to, as Michael said, the source of. Mm-hmm. So think of it that way rather than this sort of female.
Matrix. Use the word matrix. It's a completely feminine term. Matrix is a feminine term.
Okay.
It relates to kind of like a womb, right? I mean, it's basically a space
structure.
Gives rise to the expression of wisdom, which is skillful means in this case, expressing itself specifically to suit circumstances.
Okay, so the topic for today is how the sun sees the clouds. There are 5 questions. They're all discussed on page 62 to 63. They're called the 5 wisdoms. And let's see, I would like to be able to say something about each one of them.
Because,
well, so let's see how we can move through that. So what is Dharmadatta wisdom? This is the central wisdom of how the Buddha sees. Is the Buddha's mind blank or fuzzy or lacking in clarity of all details of phenomena?
It's clear.
It's clear, yeah. Brilliantly clear.
Spacious.
Spacious and unobstructed view of everything. It doesn't lack any ability to see the world.
That's why sometimes a crystal ball is the symbol of that mind. Clear, and unobstructed.
Mm.
Okay, then we have, what is mirror-like wisdom? Does the Buddha notice the suffering of sentient beings? Take note of the word, is it just oblivious? What is the mirror-like wisdom?
Seeing it like it is.
Seeing it like it is. Does he see that sentient beings appear to be suffering from their own view? Yeah, he sees that. Right?
Yeah.
It doesn't escape him that there are all these beings, at least they think they're real, they seem to think that they're suffering, and it does not escape the Buddha's attention that this is so, that there's myriad sentient beings in this world and beyond this world and 10 million worlds and however you care to follow it. The Buddha sees the suffering of sentient beings. What is the next one?
Equality.
The wisdom of equality. What is that? Yeah?
Unbiased.
You're biased.
Unbiased. I am biased, yes.
Oh, okay.
But it is unbiased.
I didn't hear. Unbiased. The Buddha has no favorites. The Buddha is not tilted towards maybe the people who are trying hard or those, as opposed to those who are stupid or evil. The Buddha, it doesn't mean he can treat them all equally, but the Buddha has no favorites. All sentient beings are worthy of the Buddha's compassion. So we're getting some sense of how the Buddha's operating. Total spaciousness and clarity. Seeing everything that's going on the apparent suffering of apparent beings who think the real is not escaping him. He has no game to play in terms of the ones he likes and doesn't like, unlike the good gods, say.
Or the God of the Hebrew Bible.
He played a bunch of favorites. So, but the Buddha has no favorites. His compassion is equally for all, and he's radiating like the sun. What is the next one?
Wait, Roberta, do you have a question? Yes?
Oh, I have lots of them that don't go on.
If you want to add something to this, of being totally unbiased.
Well, one way to think of it is if you think of the Buddha as the sun, the rays go out and they shine over everything without choice. That you're just, that's the equality aspect.
Yeah, no, I wasn't questioning.
Yeah, that's one way to think of it.
Now, the next one is interesting, and I didn't provide a hint there. Discriminating.
I like this one.
What?
This one's my favorite.
She wants to talk about
discriminating
that.
Awareness.
Because I am biased. This one's my favorite. What is discriminating awareness wisdom? You and I talked about this. It's knowing what to do, essentially. It's being able to, because you're unbiased, mm-hmm. and you're not biased, you're able to see all the details of what's going on, and therefore simply know what to do.
Well, that's a little more of the fifth one, I think.
I think it was just
moving into the state of activity.
It's not so much doing.
It's knowing perception. What to do.
It's the actual state of perception itself. You're seeing through the nature of thought. You're seeing through what obscures people and beings, sentient beings, from their own Buddha nature. You actually perceive, you can discern through that perception.
Through their deception?
You see through all deception. You realize there's no fundamental deception because you realize fundamentally nature. We talked about how there is no, what does that mean? Right. There is no deception, right? That's a very interesting statement if you ever contemplate it.
Yeah.
Normally, when we talk about discriminating, it means discriminating like, dislike, want, don't
right.
want.
Okay? Right.
So here, the Buddha is not seeing what it is that sentient beings want.
Got it.
What is he seeing?
Right.
If not what they... He's not seeing what they want.
What they need.
What they need. Yeah. What would benefit them?
Right.
Okay, Roberta.
I do have a question. I think I'm missing the whole boat because we're talking about Buddha.
Yeah.
Like he's still around up there in the sky. Oh. And
no, he's still around.
Think of.
He's not anywhere.
You mean like a thief, like a thief from a theistic.
Yeah, it sounds
with a long
very,
white beard.
It sounds. Solid.
It does sound that way from our conversation.
You know, when people take refuge vows, they take refuge in the Buddha.
Yeah.
As what?
I don't know.
As an example of wisdom. The person himself. But you are the Buddha. That's what we just talked about.
You recognize your own potential.
Your own potential.
You have Buddha nature. You're taking refuge in the truth of that. And you know that there was a human being who achieved enlightenment in one lifetime, and you recognize that as an example of that own of the possibility that you can actually work towards with your own practice. So that's what we're taking. We're taking refuge in the fundamental nature of Buddha nature itself. And that's what we do again and again and again. We don't just do this once, we do it continuously.
It's not just the Buddha, it's all Buddhas.
Yes, all Buddhas.
Yeah.
All Buddhas.
Yeah. All Buddhas, all realized ones.
Yeah, I understand that Buddha nature, it makes sense, like everybody has Buddha nature. But we're talking about Buddha in a way that is...
Well, we're talking
about Buddha in a way which is not about space and time, okay?
Yeah.
It's not about... a historical person.
Buddha is everything that is wisdom. And
this all, is all our potential as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we may have not such so much clarity here on all these five wisdoms. They may be clouded over and sometimes shine through, but it's not that they're not there. The potential is there all the time.
Buddha is our potential.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely. A plus.
But as, okay. Yes. And as we start to circle in our own, even beyond our knowing it, we may start, it may be that we have more genuine peacefulness, more ability to hold or see, more actual self-respect, more respect for others, all on a very quiet, unboastful level, beyond grabbing for any of these. And we actually discussed this as the term Xinjiang when we talked about the samskaras, that people start to notice the radiation of a Buddha because it's real.
But I think we're getting out of off the question of what is discriminating awareness wisdom.
Right,
discriminating awareness.
So I think that you this is not something we're going to do anything about. This is not knowing what to do. It's not the action plan. It's not like, okay, guys, let's go. We know what, you know, synchronize our watches or that kind of stuff. So we're actually looking at seeing the nature of reality. We're seeing the nature of truth. This is what the nature of emptiness is. And the discriminating awareness that actually sees that. And that's what is the fundamental basis of liberation. So if we study the text of the sutra, we actually see that the process of recognizing the basic empty nature or open nature of phenomena, of all experience, is completely in itself liberated in its own empty nature. Emptiness itself is liberation. It doesn't just bring liberation.
I would say that is kind of implicit all the way from the first one, but
we want to
yeah,
really stick
but
with
the I want to stick with what's here, and also if I need to find something like Mipham and cite him, I could find the same thing. That discriminating awareness sees what is a benefit
to the others,
as opposed to what people are simply being
done. Right.
What is needed to be done is there.
Right.
Then we're on the next question.
Then, and that, if we've got that far, then we can get to the last one, which is the
all accomplishing wisdom.
What do you think? See in there.
So, I mean, I'm just thinking about sort of someone I'm dealing with. I'm thinking about that it's sort of to be able to see what's really going on and not have your own prejudices in there, and then being able to let go of all of it's me and I'm smart and I'm whatever, but to then see what's needed and go do that.
Mm. Which is the fifth one.
Which is so hard.
Yeah.
Mm.
This came up last class for you as well. Yeah, this was the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
Same thing. Right. Like, I see it the motivation and the power.
But the all accomplishment, all accomplishment is
coming. Let's see. Let's give people a chance to answer that one, Michael.
What's that? It's always compassion. I mean,
does all accomplishing wisdom imply action at that point?
Absolutely, it is action.
So it is acting upon your discernment, upon your the awareness.
Yeah, now, of course, it can be said that these don't have to be thought of in sequence. They can come all at once, but we have to have a way of talking about them at least.
Mm-hmm.
So, is the Buddha efficient in getting something done?
Mm-hmm.
Does the Buddha waste energy?
Yeah. It'll be right there.
Yeah, does the Buddha understand? then what actual levers in the world accomplish things?
It seems to me in the first question, I mean, my first reaction to that is that the Buddha doesn't see clouds.
Okay, yeah.
But if the clouds are what gets in our way...
Right, it's our clouds.
So then, like, when you're trying to help someone, you see, like, you're not doing what you need to do, and I see why.
You're making the clouds.
But the question at the beginning is, does the Buddha see the clouds? What does the sun see?
And I'm just, so they see the clouds, other people's
clouds. Buddha doesn't see the clouds.
No, they see other people's clouds.
Right.
Oh,
right. Yeah. It's not clouds around the sun. It's clouds around the person.
Right.
Other people's clouds.
Yeah. The Buddha is not seeing the clouds as an obscuration. The Buddha is seeing that they're sentient beings who have confusion. Or who think they have confusion.
And because he sees, or the Buddha generically associated with anything, because the Buddha sees the clouds for what they are, then recognizes the fundamental nature itself. This is where all accomplishing is effortless, in the sense of when you actually explore these energies. It's not like everybody's rolling up their sleeves and working hard. This is something that actually immediately dispels the issue.
That is
the essential point, that what the what the Buddha is effortless. The Buddha is not trying to help sentient beings. The Buddha is not trying to see clearly. This is all the spontaneous awareness, activity, clarity, luminosity of Buddha nature. And
it's also knowing the right time and the sort of the right time, place, and therefore all these it's sort of the activity arises out of the correct circumstances. So it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, there's a lot of work involved.
Well, the activity is more what we call bodhisattva. When we talk about bodhisattvas and what they're doing, they are doing the activity. They are actually doing the work.
And so their wisdom is motivating them somehow to do that good
work. They're utterly motivated by basic compassion and the fundamental nature of devotion and compassion together.
That's okay, the whole background of this whole thing is compassion.
There is this great couple sentence here. Therefore, Buddha's wisdom is not just knowing everything about everything, then leaning back and letting the world roll by on its own. It means knowing everything about suffering and happiness, including their causes, having the motivation to benefit others through that knowledge, and also having the power to accomplish that benefit. These three elements have to come together, or Buddha wisdom is not going to do any good.
That summarizes
63.
It.
63.
Yeah. Maybe it summarizes in 3 points rather than five, but it's the same thing.
That's
why what you read at the beginning was so significant about the different ways the Buddha, the Bodhisattva teaches or responds.
So ultimately, there's an emptiness and compassion seen from even now. More enlightened view.
It's an acting class.
Oh!
That's what they, they practice getting mad and doing things.
Is that her all her wisdom?
Or is it for
view?
The show? I don't know if it's the class or the rehearsing.
It's an interview.
What?
I don't know if it's the class or the rehearsing the show.
It could be, I don't know.
It's an employee's assessment.
Oh boy, back to the job.
At 9 o'clock at night.
Okay. Does anyone want to say anything further?
Well, I just think about the whole situation of how this group got started as sort of the process of these five, and at the end, it's sort of like, you know, we show up on a certain day, we meet certain people, and the group, the church had already said they wanted a Buddhist group, and we meet Elise, and so it happened. You know, it just, that all accomplishing wisdom was the right circumstance, the right time, the right longing,
from our group, we had been meeting already for a year. How can we teach the Dharma? Where can we go to do this? We want to keep these teachings alive. And, you know, I said, the Unitarians, they love the Buddhists. And so let's go find a place. And, you know, different groups. Well, Michael started, like another group started too. What?
We don't like religion.
You had been in Nashua.
The church.
Right?
Yeah.
There was a Unitarian church.
Yes. There was a Unitarian. We didn't start that group, but we did teach in Nashua. Yeah. And then at the same time,
it's
Michael and some other people started something in Harvard. Well, it ended up in Harvard Square.
I started with them too, but
And also Jim Wilton. So things, it's sort of like the situation was longing to happen, and so it did. You know, I think there's sort of this quality of all of these wisdoms that are kind of beyond, in a way, you know, I'm doing this. You know?
Right.
It's beyond ego enhancement and advancement. It just, things come together. Mm-hmm. That's my summary.
Okay, shall we end it here?
Amen.
Sure.
Yes.
Amen.
Amen. Hallelujah.
No, no,
praise the Lord.
Oops.
We have to dedicate them. All right, there we go.